Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books, and we interview the authors of those books. This week I'm very happy to say that we have Larry Samuel on the show, and we'll be talking about his fascinating book, Shrink, A Cultural History of Psychoanalysis in America. I found this book very, very interesting, partially to do with the fact that I have had some contact with the psychological profession. Yes, very helpful people they are. And I didn't really know much about the origins of it in the American context, except to say that it was kind of an import. Larry does an excellent job of explaining a lot more than that, and the kinds of ebb and flow of, in this case, psychoanalysis in American culture, why in America psychoanalysis was for a moment very popular, and why it has become less popular and more popular over time, and who the key figures were in disseminating it. And I guess I would say adapting it to American culture, because that's a major portion of the book. So, Larry, thank you for writing the book, and thank you for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Marshall. Good to be here.
Yeah, so maybe you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. Again, my name is Larry Samuel. I live in Miami most of the year, but I spend summers in New York City. And I grew up in New York, and right now I am an author and consultant. I write books all over 20th century cultural history, pretty much, and do some consulting on the side, sort of offering cultural insights to Fortune 500 companies under the name Culture Planning. So that's sort of my gig, either writing cultural history or, you know, sort of reading American culture, contemporary American culture for clients today.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my two jobs.
Mm-hmm. So tell us why you wrote Shrink, A Cultural History of Psychoanalysis in America.
Yeah, well, I had written another book called Freud on Madison Avenue a few years ago, which was all about motivation research and subliminal advertising. And it was that sort of technique was the darling of Madison Avenue during the 50s. And this guy, Ernest Dichter, maybe your listeners have heard of Dichter, used a ton of Freud's theories and psychoanalytic theories to do his work. So I got interested in psychoanalysis sort of through the back door, through Ernest Dichter's work and through motivation research. I wanted to know more about, you know, these theories and techniques that he was using and that became so popular in advertising in the 50s. So this is just sort of the backdrop to that. And the more I delved into it, the more fascinating it became. The other reason I wrote it, I happened to be on a bus in New York City, and I saw an ad on the bus for T-Mobile with the headline, "Give your faves phone envy." Give your faves, like favorites, phone envy. And I realized it was a reference to Freud's, you know, more anatomical theory. And it led me to believe, you know, how entrenched the language of psychoanalysis and Freudian language particularly is in American culture. And so I started doing research and found that it went, you know, all the way back to really the beginnings after World War I is when this all started.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it a fascinating story.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we could jump right into the story. How does, do you want to limit it to psychoanalysis? How does psychoanalysis mm-hmm. come to the United States?
Yeah, well, Freud is developing his theories around the turn of the 20th century in Vienna, of course. He does make a trip to America in 1909. It's a disaster. He gets stomach disease and he's sick and everything. He hates America after that. But it really isn't. Yeah, he says he'll never come back, and he never does, actually, after being invited to Clark University, where the president was a big fan of Freud's theories. So there is some trickling in from Europe for his theories before World War I, but it isn't really till after the war that they hit America big time. Right after the war, modernism, of course, is approaching and encroaching everywhere. And the cultural elite and bohemians start hearing about his theories and embrace it. So that's really the beginnings of it. It's sort of a top-down, you know, they take it on, and then eventually it trickles down into middle-brow culture, mm-hmm. into where just, you know, ordinary people are using the language of psychoanalysis in ordinary conversations mm-hmm. in 1920.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who were the people who popularized it in terms of psychoanalysis itself in the United States in the 1920s? Were there particular stars who spoke to this cultural elite?
It was more wealthy people. It mm-hmm. became, you know, sort of a rich man's plaything is what it was called. But also in the village, in Greenwich Village, the bohemian sort of artistic, artsy types embraced it. They were interested more in the intellectual component, which we forget about. It was just this, you know, new body of research and ideas that no one really had thought about before. You know, principally the idea of the unconscious was basically the breakthrough idea that there's this, you know, entirely new territory that we had yet to explore. It was interesting that it came sort of right after, the closing of the American frontier. You know, at the end of the 20th century, Frederick Jackson Turner, you know, famously said that, you know, where we basically have explored the continent, we're running out of land. Well, here was this new territory, you know, more of an ideological one or an idea-based one that was open territory. So I think that was part of the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
But there's terms like, you know, suppressed desires or conflicts began to appear in ordinary conversations immediately in the 1920s as Freud's ideas take the country by storm.
Mm-hmm.
You also see it showing up in novels, you know, by Sherwood Anderson or Theodore Dreiser and F. Scott Fitzgerald. You could tell that writers now, novelists in particular, are reading Freud, or at least learning about him, and are using some of his ideas to shape some of their narratives, which spreads further, you know, into readers, because then they start reading the novels and learning the language. So.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You're also seeing it even in interpretations like literary criticism. Like, people are starting to think, well, what if Shakespeare was familiar with Freud? You know, is there Freudian ideas, even though it was 300 years before? Yeah, Freud, you know, in the language of Hamlet or Macbeth, like, there seemed to be woven in those narratives some Freudian ideas. So it's happening in criticism as well.
Mm-hmm. And what did these intellectuals, I guess I would call them, hope to accomplish with Freudianism? Were they critiquing American culture, or did they hope to find themselves? And this is something you talk about in the book, about the Americanization of psychoanalysis.
Right. I think it's to that idea that that a lot of our mind, a lot of what we were thinking, and even how we're behaving, stems from the unconscious. Was really the big through that we're not really in control. Basically, because it was a reminder that we were animals, you know, that we're slaves to the basic drives of hunger and sex and our desires. So just as, you know, everything else is becoming modern and during the machine age, here was this sort of alternative idea that brought us back to the idea that we were not machines, that we're animals, and we're basically a slave to our desires, especially towards what happened to us, you know, in childhood, which, again, is a key Freudian idea that a childhood trauma basically will imprint us for the rest of our lives. So that really was intriguing to people, as is the idea of dreams. You know, if you went to a party in any kind of smart cocktail party and you talked about your dreams, they would be interpreted through a Freudian lens. So, you know, instantly people start reading things through a Freudian lens, especially dreams. So that's very intriguing to people.
Mm-hmm. How did the, I guess what I would call it, the establishment, although it wasn't very well established at the time, psychiatric and psychological establishment, I guess? How did it respond to the growth of
right.
Freudianism in popular culture?
I think one of the keys that psychoanalysis takes hold so quickly here and so firmly is that there really wasn't an established psychiatric committee as much as in Europe. It was pretty much still evolving here in America, whereas in Germany and in Austria, it went back quite a few decades. So there, of course, they were much more resistant to Freud's idea, ironically. He was except within the inner circle, you know, in Vienna, with people a lot like Freud, the general public was not really interested in ideas. Whereas in America, the psychiatric community was still taking shape, and psychoanalysis just, you know, took hold. That became the dominant method of psychoanalysis, and it had a good, what, 50-year run, 40-year run, before other therapies started really to erode that in a significant way. Mm-hmm. But just all kinds of folks began using the therapy in different ways. You had doctors, for the first time, really, in America, seeing the link between the mind and the body, which went back, of course, all the way to Hippocrates and other folks. But here now, you know, they're looking at patients and thinking pneumonia, typhoid fever, even the flu, could be due to a lack of love in that person's life. Or if someone had impaired vision or hearing, they're thinking now that might be a result of some sort of childhood psychic conflict, which is just a huge breakthrough in medicine. People in Western medicine never really thought about the mind in that way. So that was a huge contribution of the field as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that I noticed in reading the book about the appeal of this to a certain elite, a moneyed elite in America, is that I know I've studied the history of Alcoholics Anonymous a little bit. I've written a little bit about that. And one of the kind of key moments in the origins of Alcoholics Anonymous is a person who is an alcoholic and goes and seeks treatment on the advice of his, these are all Manhattanites, goes and seeks treatment with Jung in Switzerland for alcoholism. He does it a couple of times. These are very moneyed people. The idea is that he has to go to Europe to get the real cure because that's where it is. Right.
It becomes a real status symbol. It's a real social, a sign of social status that you are engaged in learning more about yourself. You know, it was sort of this inward discovery that if you had the time and money and you needed lots of it, but a good number of people in the 1920s did, you would take that trip.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go to get training to be a psychoanalyst in the 1920s and 30s in the United States? Did you go back to Europe?
Yeah, you would have to. There were really no training institutes in the United States until the 1930s. You would have to go to Europe. And this is after, of course, earning a medical degree. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until much later, sort of, I think it was like the 70s or 80s, where non-physicians were allowed to become analysts. So you would get your medical degree. And then on top of that, spend a number of years, in a psychoanalytic institute in Europe, preferably Vienna, where you would be psychoanalyzed, and that was actually part of the education as well. And then you would come back to America. So it was an incredible commitment, and which is why you see very few young ones. You'd have to be almost 40 by the time you would become an analyst. And then in the 30s, of course, you had hundreds of Jewish emigree, analysts fleeing Nazis. So that happened in a big way in the 30s when all those analysts came over and sort of seeded what happened during the war and after the war when psychoanalysts got much bigger.
Yeah, and let's talk about that a little bit. It really takes off after the war. That is, it becomes not just a language in which elites speak about things and interpret things, but a lot more people start to seek out analysts and a lot more Americans start to become analysts. And it also takes hold, I should say, I'm guessing it took hold in just certain areas of the United States, the most important of which being New York, but a couple of other places. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, most of those analysts did settle in New York. And to this day, New York City and specifically Greenwich Village around 10th Street is the highest density of psychoanalysts and psychiatrists in the world. But basically, after the 20s, it was sort of faddish in a way, and it died down a bit in the 30s because it was seen as a rich man's plaything. Anything associated with the wealthy elite was sort of disliked at the time. It was blamed, as sort of an excess of the 1920s. So in 1930s, it was really unsure what was going to happen. World War II really legitimizes the method, as it's called, or the talking cure, because now you have people in high positions in the government and the military who come from a psychoanalytic background, like Menninger, for example. So it's basically blessed by the government and achieves sort of an official endorsement as a legitimate therapy rather than just a fad. So that's the basis or the foundation for what happens after the war, when it becomes really part of middle-class culture. You go back in movies or even television shows and you can see references to psychoanalysis. So it basically trickles down from the wealthy elite, from, bohemian culture into mass culture. You're seeing Americans with basically simple troubles. Mrs. Draper, by the way, Betty Draper, you see that, of course, mm-hmm. in Mad Men, you know, who has some issues. She goes to a psychoanalyst in the first season. So that's a good example of really what happened in real life. Basically, Americans think of it as sort of getting a checkup. Instead of your physical body, you know, you're going to the doctor or dentist. You know, you're going to shrink now to check up on what's going in your mind. So it really becomes part of mass culture. The critics really don't like this. They just feel like Americans have too much money on their, you know, time in the hand. The method was never designed for the general public or the masses, which was true. Freud would have been shocked. He died in 1939. But he would have been shocked to see how broad his therapy had become and how diluted it had become because it didn't resemble what he envisioned in the early part of the 20th century at all in some ways.
And he, just to stop there, he envisioned
it. Basically, it takes hold in America. You have neo-Freudians who are splitting off from Freudians. You know, the strict Freudians still look through life through a sexual lens, basically. The analysts tend to be aloof and formal and very tough on patients, whereas these neo-Freudians, which is entirely new school, don't focus as much on sexuality as aggression as our primary drive. And they're warmer, they're less formal, they're sympathetic. And this lays the foundation, of course, for the behavioral and cognitive movement in the 60s and 70s, which still today is the dominant method of therapy. So you're seeing lots of spin-offs pop up in the 50s. You have client-centered or non-directive therapy from Carl Rogers, even Dianetics by L. Ron Hubbard, who becomes, you know, Mr. Scientology. And you're also seeing in the 50s it grow in pop culture. So, you know, the method becomes sort of a staple of in sort of highbrow culture like the New Yorker cartoons we remember, or the Jules Pfeiffer cartoons in The Village Voice, and just some jokes. People are telling knock-knock jokes with the analyst as sort of the butt of the joke. This is just ordinary, you know, Americans who are very familiar with the language and discourse of psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I found this part about what Freud intended and what transpired on American soil to be very interesting. Could you talk a little bit about what Freud intended with psychoanalysis? Did he believe it was simply just for extraordinarily sick people, or
Marshall?
Yeah,
I don't hear you as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me try this again. Let me play a little bit with it. Hold on.
Okay.
Can you hear me now?
A little better. I don't know what if it's. I've got my phone on Mac, but. Try it one more time.
Okay, can you hear me now?
I can. It's not as good as what it was.
Huh. Well, let me actually.
Earlier,
I could call you back and we could try for a new line.
I just want to make sure I can hear your question.
Okay. Is this all right then?
Okay.
So.
Yes.
All right. So the question is, I was very interested in this thing that you said about Freud's original intent with psychoanalysis and the way that it developed on American soil in the 1950s. What did Freud originally intend psychoanalysis to do, and what was its clientele, or who was its clientele?
Right. Yeah, well, in Europe, in Vienna, he did treat wealthy people. They were really the few people that could afford the therapy to see him or his colleagues, you know, who had the time and money to do it. Most of them were women. We have to remember that Vienna, you know, circa 1900 was an entirely different place than America in the 50s. But he really screened his candidates carefully. I mean, they did have to have money, but he had to be intrigued by their particular problem. I don't know if some of your listeners saw The Dangerous Method, the movie, you know, that recently came out. It, you know, these were people with real emotional issues. He just didn't want to, you know, treat people who were slightly depressed, which is what, of course, happened later in sort of post-war America. So he had to be intrigued by the problem. These people have serious issues, but not be insane. Basically, psychoanalysis will not work for them, he felt. But he was basically feeling that if you could get a third of the people cured, a third of the people like slightly improved, and a third of the people no improvement, he was doing a good job. That's all that he had hoped for. He never felt that his therapy or any kind of psychiatric therapy would make people happy. He didn't believe people could be happy. He just wanted to get people to what he called essentially an ordinary state of misery. So he was not what you call a cockeyed optimist. He really looked towards the darker side of human behavior, and his therapy was well suited for that. I mean, that's what he wanted people to talk about in free association, to, you know, was the dark stuff in their unconscious. He wanted to really get at that stuff that was traumatic in their childhood and reach the surface. And it was only then he felt that you could achieve synthesis, which is sort of a unity between your conscious thoughts and your unconscious.
So he saw therapy as a place to have a kind of cathartic moment that wouldn't be particularly pleasant, but would be revealing.
I heard the cathartic moment, but
So he saw therapy as a kind of cathartic moment, one that wouldn't be particularly pleasant, but would be revealing.
Yeah, he really wanted to. Yeah, it would take years sometimes to reach that breakthrough point, but that was the goal. He expected it to take years, over sometimes as much as five times a week, to penetrate deeply into that unconscious for that childhood experience that you had that really imprinted you and made you an unhappy person as an adult. But eventually you would have that breakthrough. It wasn't at all like in the movies where, you know, someone who couldn't walk because of some traumatic event in their childhood could suddenly walk because of it coming up in conversation. That was obviously Hollywood's version of it. But there would be, in essence, a cathartic moment, a moment where you would be healed from your past and you would be a happier, at least a more content person in your daily life.
Right. But in the 1950s, I guess what you're saying is that it became an aspect of the American pursuit of happiness. That is, Americans used it to treat, not to put too fine a point on it, either a situational depression or a chronic depression.
Right. I think as we became a more therapeutic culture, and as the therapy movement sort of wed itself to the self-help movement, we began to think of happiness as an entitlement, that we deserve to be happy, that we should be happy, and that if we weren't unhappy, there was something wrong with us. Whereas Freud, you know, didn't see that way at all. He did not expect us to be happy. But in America, we're an optimistic sort of can-do culture. There was a long history of looking towards other people to help solve our problems, to help make us happy. And psychoanalysis sort of glommed onto that and became seen as a way to, you know, to get that happiness. But I don't blame Freud for, you know, the narcissism that's all around us, for this me-based culture that really began taking off in the me decade, the 70s, and I think is still with us today. It was really the what I call, you know, the mixed therapies, and then our drug-based therapeutic culture that turned Americans into, you know, people that expected therapy to deliver happiness to them. Freud never promised that. He didn't expect that. He would be appalled by what happened, you know, in America with therapy. So it was a much different brand of therapy as he envisioned it during his lifetime to the 30s than what evolved here in America and then much later.
I see. And pretty quickly, there is a backlash by the 1960s. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Yeah, I mean, at this point, you know, Freud's ideas which were conceived in Vienna in the early part of the 20th century just don't have much currency anymore in, you know, say, mid-1960s America. You don't have to be repressed. You can do it pretty much ever you want. So the idea of repression just sort of goes away. You know, we're not a repressed culture anymore. So they just start not playing well. I think I write in my book that his ideas start looking as dated as a Victorian horsehair sofa. You know, they just look really dated, especially against, you know, what's going on in other therapy. You know, you have these turtlenecked, warm and cuddly, fuzzy therapists versus the strict Freudian. And we become an anti-authoritative culture at that point. So anyone, especially a psychoanalyst, just doesn't fare very well. You know, you see that in Annie Hall. It's a great example of contrasting the new kind of therapy that Annie Hall is going to versus Woody Allen's character, who's going to the strict Freudian. And it just gets worse after that in the 70s. You know, the method goes into a tailspin. partly because of managed care, insurance companies are very happy to cover pharmacology and these sort of quick fix therapies, 10 sessions and you're out, versus psychoanalysis, which takes years. You know, they don't really want to cover that. So that's another big blow to this particular form of therapy that only can got worse, you know, in the HMO era of the 80s and 90s. So there's a huge backlash. You have other therapies like encounter groups, you know, in the 70s, you know, which are just much hipper than just talking about your problems. Now you're moving or touching. It's basically the whole counterculture's rejection of discipline and authority and all kinds of other therapies. I think there's like 200 therapies by 1970, with psychoanalysis just as a therapy maybe counting for 2%. But the big point I make in my book is that the role of psychoanalysis in American culture far exceeds its role as a therapy as far back as the 1950s. Mm-hmm. It becomes a really minor presence on the therapy scene, but ubiquitous in popular culture. You know, it just becomes sort of a staple trope in movies or television or books, which is really the main point. I'm much more interested in how it played out in everyday life and its role just as sort of this strange set of theories that Freud developed mm-hmm. as a therapy.
Mm-hmm. So talk to us a little bit about that. You mentioned Annie Hall, which is one of my favorite movies. Where else do we see it in, say, American popular culture and in, I guess, quotidian life?
Well, I mean, there was a long history in the movies. You know, Spellbound is a great example of seeing it, you know, sort of in the post-war era. But by the time, you know, the 80s and 90s roll around, you're seeing it, of course, in The Sopranos, which sort of puts it over the top because it's a more or less accurate depiction of the process. You know, you have this complex character who had childhood trauma. I think it was that his father, you know, he saw his father killed, who was also a gangster, and has this contentious relationship with his therapist, who's in turn seeing her own therapist, which often happens. So I think it's The Sopranos, and then after that, the Gabriel Byrne, you know, In Treatment, which seals it as a staple of American pop culture. Mm-hmm. But you could see it, you know, in The Simpsons. You know, there's references to psychoanalysis, which is, I think is great. So if Homer Simpson is talking about Freud's theories, you know, it's everywhere in American culture.
Mm-hmm. It also appears in, again, one of my favorite movies called House of Games. Have you seen this movie? It's a David Mamet play made into a movie, and it's very Freudian, and it's about a psycho.
I'm sorry, Marshall. What's it called?
It's called House of Games.
Oh yes. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's there, and it's a really terrific movie. I really enjoyed it. So, I guess one of the things I'm interested in is why does it hang on in the 60s and 70s when it seems to have fallen out of fashion among many practitioners?
Yeah, well, it's sort of an amazing story because just when you do think it's dead in the water as a result of all the blows that it's taken, you know, mostly there's no scientific proof of that it's working. You know, the feminists have complained against it. The Vatican has complained against it. You know, managed care isn't covering anymore. It basically, you think it'll just completely go away. But in the 90s, it does make a comeback, just as Spragos is sort of getting popular, ironically, because a couple of things are happening. What people are finding is that these mixed therapies, you know, these short-term fixes, just don't stick. The results do not stick. You cannot go for just a few sessions and have something, you know, from your childhood, deep trauma, just solved. So a lot of patients are finding that they're attracted to more long-term therapies than drugs, or, you know, which will not make your problems go away. They might cover them up, or these quick fix therapies. So just on the therapeutic level, there's a backlash against the short-term fixes towards psychoanalysis. You're also seeing basically neuroscience, for the first time, proving that a lot of Freud's theories do seem to be rooted in biology, that there is an unconscious, you know, that the MRI scans can prove that a lot of our mental activity is taking place in this zone of the brain that is not conscious to us, really does support Freud's theories. And Freud was a neuroscientist. We forget that. He was a neuroscientist in the late 1900s, but he was a neuroscientist, and he predicted that biology would one day prove that his theories were correct, which happened. So the first time there's scientific validity. You're also having psychoanalysis become sort of a kinder, gentler therapy through psychodynamic therapy. So it isn't the strict Freudian therapy that it was, you know, in the early part of the 20th century. There is some room for the therapist to borrow, for, you know, have a more eclectic approach, dip into some other therapies, not have to go five times a day, which the insurance company isn't going to pay for. So I think through that, it sort of realized it had to modify itself to reach, you know, to stay alive. So I think that's is another reason why the method is still exists today. And it happens to be stronger than it was in the last few decades. I think there are about a number of patients today as there was in the late 60s. So it made a good comeback. I call it the comeback couch.
Yeah. Another thing that I found interesting was that, and I know this from personal experience as an academic, somebody who went to graduate school in the 1980s, early 1990s, and that is that it never died in academia. It never died there.
Right. No, that's true. It was always in academia. Ironically, it was not in psychology books, purely, you know, except as a footnote. But you would find references to it in history and in other disciplines. Psychology tended to marginalize it. But, you know, the intellectual elite to this day were always attracted to psychoanalysis.
Yeah, literary criticism is still quite wedded to it. And cultural criticism is still quite wedded to it. Yeah.
Lacanian theory.
Right, exactly. It's still very wedded to to that program. So, I mean, one thing I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about I'm thinking of a person who might listen to the show and say, yeah, I want to see a psychoanalyst today.
Right.
How are psychoanalysts trained today, and how do you go about seeing them? I don't know the answer to that question, even though, as I said in the sort of introduction,
right.
I do see someone. It is not a psychoanalyst.
Yeah. Right.
And so how do you go about it? What is the culture of it today?
Well, I mean, of course, you could just ask your friends who they're seeing, recommend someone. But there's tons of reference. So Psychology Today has, you know, the magazine and the website has a wonderful, website devoted towards finding a therapist. And then you just sort of learn more about their method. And what you would find today is that it would be very hard to find a strict Freudian psychoanalyst. I would challenge you to do so, except in certain pockets of New York City in the Village, perhaps. So if this person does use any of psychoanalytic theory, it would be more through psychodynamic, in that, again, this kinder, sort of gentler, borrowing on some of Freud's ideas, but a much more eclectic approach that borrows on, you know, cognitive and behavioral, that's rooted in some of what Freud's ideas, you know, are talking about, that there might have been some childhood trauma, that a lot of what we're thinking about takes place in the unconscious. Those aren't going to change. Those are just based the staples of the field. But without the craziness, some of the really strict stuff that Freud had, you know, back in the early days, that you weren't allowed to make any important decisions while you were in therapy, you know, that you had to go five times a week, all kinds of really rigid rules that were hurting the field. So, you know, I would encourage a person to go to that website or go to another website where there's, you know, references to different therapists, and just see what their method is.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll definitely find that there, you know, the talking cure is still sort of the backdrop towards therapy. You know, talking with someone, either just discussing the problems or working with your therapist and trying to solve them, which Freud would never have done, to offer advice of any kind. But of course, therapy is much more about that today.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, the talking cure, because sometimes I call it that. I know that when I see the person I see, we talk about my past. Usually.
Right.
And it, you know, again, I've read a lot of Freud. I even taught some Freud at one point in my academic career. And I'm very cognizant of the fact that that method, the talking cure, and particularly, you know, if it is hysterical, it's historical. This has become a kind of bedrock of all talking cures, no matter where you're trained.
Well, pretty much. I mean, you know, for the brief time there was, the encounter group where people didn't want to talk. They really just wanted to touch and move, or the primal screen therapy, you know, which moved away from talking. But I think people got back to talking, and now the wave is not to just talking about your problems, but really trying to solve them. And your therapist plays an advisory role in trying to steer you the right direction, which is a deviation from
Oh yeah, they give advice. There's no question. Totally. They give advice. They definitely
do. Yeah,
they give advice.
I think also, yeah, but there is much more of a present day focus on therapy today. You know, the therapists I know, sort of my friends, really stress the present and try not to dwell on the past.
Yeah, yeah.
I personally think, you know, you're a product of your past, that the past is who we are. You know, the present is very fleeting. It's like gone.
Yeah, it is.
It is. The future hasn't happened yet. Yeah. So what do we really have? We're receptacles of the past, I think.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. So what do you see as the future of psychoanalysis in America? I mean, you say it's a little bit on the uptick right now. What kind of your general stance toward it?
Right. Well, I'm sort of bullish on it. Again, because of what happened beginning in the 90s with neuroscience basically supporting a lot of Freud's theories and the backlash against quicker cures and Prozac Nation. So I'm sort of bullish on it. I'm also bullish on it because it's expanding to Europe. Ironically, after 100 years after it left Europe, it's going to places like Spain. It's very popular right now. And it's also becoming incredibly popular in Asia, in China, and India. A lot of Chinese are using Skype to talk with analysts in the United States. And now, finally, a lot more analysts are can be found in China for the first time. So if you think about 1 billion people who had not been exposed to this therapy, they're basically 100 years too late.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge number of people to be in psychoanalysis. So I'm encouraged for that extent as well. And I think basically that, through just the legitimacy that it is more of a science rather than just an art, which it was considered until data basically proved a lot of its theories. But now we have MRIs, basically proving that a lot of our thoughts are in the unconscious. So the biological underpinning to it, I think, is a reason to be bullish on the therapy.
Mm-hmm. And so I take it you're a critic of medication for feeling bad.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think if you think about it, on one level it's very dated, given its origins, but it's very in sync with the times. You know, to get in touch with who you are as a person, to evolve as a person, particularly baby boomers who are really, trying to march up Maslow's hierarchy, and become self-actualized. This is really a great way to peel back the layers of your onion and dig deep and find out, who you are, why you've been on Earth, and what the meaning and purpose of your life is, and how to engage within the broader community. Psychoanalysis promises all that, and I think delivers a good part of that. So the deepness, the richness of it is very appealing to a lot of people.
Yeah, but it's very hard work. I mean, I've been told by the people that do it and people that have had it done to them that it's very hard work. It's a commitment.
It is hard work.
It's a real commitment.
Yeah.
And it's not something you don't go there just to feel a little bit better after the second session.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean that's always been associated. You just get beat up a lot in this form of therapy, unlike other more feel good, warm and fuzzy. This, you do, get exposed to your darker side. Learn that you may not be a perfect person or be even like a very good person. But after years, hopefully, you do, become a better person and know who you are. The motto of the therapy is basically know thyself. And that process is hard. It's really digging deep to learning who you are.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, examining your own life is a very painful thing in any context, whether it's the, the confessional booth or it's the analyst couch. I don't think they use couches anymore. I've never seen a couch in any shrink's office, but...
Yeah, that's a vestige of the past.
Yeah.
You actually look at your therapist.
Yeah.
Freud just didn't like to be looked at, which is really why he was sort of on the side.
Right, right, right. And, another thing I was going to say before we conclude is that, I did some research on the sort of industry standard or discipline standard of psychological care for people with psychological ailments as defined by the DSM, whatever we're on now, 5. And all the evidence shows that there just isn't enough of it, that there are a lot of people that could use this kind of therapy, but they don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree.
I mean, it's a tremendous number of people, a huge number of people, according to, again, if you take what the DSM says is a psychological ailment of one sort or another, and then you say, well, are they getting the standard of care that we would want optimally? They're just not.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. I think you see it in all around us. I think I don't know if you'd call it mental illness, but you know, you'd see really people who are not evolved or have major issues who could use some kind of therapy, right? Who are not getting it.
Right.
I think it is mostly in our narcissism, you know, and I'm not a Facebook person. You know, that's just an example of these people that really need to be heard. I think we all need to be heard.
Yeah.
You know, we all have a voice, and a lot of people aren't. And when it's not, it comes out in perverse, sort of frustrated ways. And I think that it's too bad. It's a big problem.
Well, I mean, this is something that I did notice when during this last school shooting. I can't remember which one it was. There are so many of them. Mm-hmm. Immediately after that, President Obama and some other people said, yeah, sure, we need to regulate access to guns, the number of guns, but we also need to expand the level of mental health coverage because these people are sick. And they're not getting treatment. And I thought, you know, here's the moment where people will finally take the bull by the horns. It's these sick people that's the problem. I mean, sure, guns, whatever. But you know, the number one most fatalities by firearms, far and away the most, are by suicide. They're not by people shooting other people. They're by people shooting themselves. And those people, I mean, again, in my mind, you can be an existentialist about it and stuff. If you want to shoot yourself, that's pretty much prima facie evidence to me that you have a mental illness of some sort. Maybe just for a moment, but like for some moment, you need help. And people can't get it, you know?
Yeah. I think, a certain class of people or a certain type of person are getting it. But it's almost those people need it less than a lot of other people. It should just be much more broadly available.
Yeah, I agree completely.
To people.
Yeah.
And especially now that the stigma behind it is mostly gone.
Yeah.
You know, there really isn't the stigma that there used to be.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I can speak to that personally. I know that my father was deeply mentally ill and ended up committing suicide. And he was never treated by a shrink. Never.
Right.
And would never do it. I mean, we were from Kansas. We just didn't do those things. But in my own life, you know, finally I had to suffer from it for a long time. But then I went.
Right.
And I got to say, you know, did it help to make me happy? No. It didn't make me happy. But do I, you know, but do I kind of understand the context of my life? Can I get along a little bit better than I did? Yes. Definitely.
Yeah.
And I owe those people everything.
You really hit on it right there. It will not make you happy, probably. Because there's research shows that, too. There's a happiness set point. You can get sort of blips of happiness in your life. You know, you win the lottery, you're happy for a little while, but then you're not, actually.
Chocolate makes me happy.
Chocolate.
That's pretty much it. I don't drink anymore, so chocolate.
There you go. But it is that sort of context that you see yourself within a broader framework, which is really helpful.
It's
hard to do by yourself.
I agree completely. Well, Larry, I really want to thank you for writing this book and for talking with us today. We've been talking with Larry Samuel about his book, Shrink, A Cultural History of Psychoanalysis in America. I want to thank everybody for listening, but I especially want to thank Larry for being on the show, and I also want to ask him our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now other than, I happen to know, lying on the beach?
Yes, I am in Key West. It could be worse. It's one of the few benefits of being a writer is that you could write pretty much anywhere. I am writing, it's sort of an obscure book, but I just felt it had to be written. I'm a cultural historian. I've written about 15 books now about some aspect of American history. I felt, you know what I'm going to write now is a history of American history, which sounds really odd, but no one has ever sort of traced the history of American history, which is a really fascinating one. I mean, American history, you know, has been around since America, you know, but I'm sort of picking up again where I began in the 1920s and sort of seeing how it changed, because believe it or not, history changes a lot. It's not, you know, a fixed thing. It really changes with the values of a particular time and place.
And how.
So that's what I'm writing.
Yeah, and how. Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. So anyway, that sounds like a fantastic project, and as a historian, I very much approve of that. So I want to congratulate you again on the book, and thank you for being on the show.
Marshall, thank you so much.
All right, thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.